This is actually the shul where my Yossi had his bar mitzvah. And I was actually thinking of how beautiful that day was. When I was a kid, we had a very special treat. My father took me and most of my siblings, there was a lot of us, there was 11 of us, and we got to go to Great Adventures. Great Adventures is one of the Six Flags, but this was a long time ago, and it was a big deal for us. We were, to put it mildly, financially limited, and we looked forward to this for a really, really long time. And when we got to Great Adventures, I was kind of young, and the first attraction that I went into was the Fun House. Oh, the haunted house. And I really, really hated it. I hated how unpredictable it was. There was like these eerie apparitions that kept popping up, and it was very dark, and you kind of had to figure out how to get out, and it wasn't very clear where to go, and worst of all, the floor kept tilting, moving under me, and I really, it was frightening for me. And on the way home, I complained. I said that I didn't like it at all, and that it was called the unfun house. I was kind of dramatic. And that I never wanted to go in that again. And, you know, my parents are kind of like European, old-fashioned parents, and there's none of that touchy-feely validation stuff. And I think my father said something like, "You continue acting like that, and you never will get to go again," or something. I grew up, and the fun house, or the unfun house, became something of my reality. And I think I understand now what the allure is, what the pull of this place is. You see, when your world is stable and steady and you're feeling secure, then there is a thrill to what we would call like an orchestrated chaos or a controlled fear. Because even though the floor is tilting and even though it's dark and scary things keep popping out, you know that you're gonna be alright. You know that somebody engineered this and, you know, they don't want to deal with problems if people don't make it out. So you kind of know, scary as it is, I believe that even as a child and as much as I didn't enjoy it, I believe that I was absolutely certain that I was gonna go home that night safe and sound in our beaten up station wagon with my siblings. So even then, it was kind of okay. The trick is, in real life, when it's dark and you can't quite figure out where the next door is, and the floor keeps tilting, and every time you get your footing, it shifts again, and scary things keep popping out, and we have to come to that same certainty. We're going to get home safe and sound. We're going to be okay. Somebody is making sure that even though it looks scary, and even though we're not sure how to go, we're going to be all right. How do we do it? Well, I always wanted a large family, and my husband and I, we had our first four children in 4 years. And when my fourth child was born, from birth, right away, he had a lot of problems. And the doctors, in the beginning, they weren't sure what it was, but they could see that this was a baby that was seriously ill. He was in the hospital for many months. And after a while, tests and experts, they told us that what our son had was an extremely unusual mitochondrial disorder, and that it was caused by a genetic defect that my husband and I share. Such a rare defect that it's one in hundreds of millions of couples. They told us that we have a better chance of winning the lottery than of having a combination like that. But they also told us, and I remember when I heard that, it was shocking to me. How could it be that my husband and I, who are, thank God, so compatible in every other way, and if you know him, you'll know why, married, thank God, now for almost 27 years, how could it be that the fact that we're married to each other is the cause for our baby to be so ill? But this is what the doctors were saying. They also told us that they did not believe that our baby had a chance to live. And then they told us that it could happen again. Same odds, what Rabbi Einbinder was saying, 75 to 25, 75% that it wouldn't. But that was our greatest fear, that it would happen again. Our little baby died, and it did happen again. And again, and again. And of the eight children that we had, four of them died from this disorder. There was the floor tilting. There was a difficulty in trying to find our way out. But you know, we're Jews. We move forward. We had, thank God, our son, our three healthy daughters. We raised our children. We filled our homes, our lives with people, with guests, with education, with life. And thank goodness our kids grew up, our girls got married, and about 2.5 years ago, our son Yossi got engaged. And Yossi was an extremely unusual child. He loved to learn. He was the kind of kid that learned even when he didn't have to. He had an extensive Sfarim collection, Hebrew books, and he would write in the margin his little notes in Hebrew. He was just naturally a scholar. It was always his wish just to be able to sit and learn. And he also liked to teach. And from the time Yossi was a young boy all the way till adulthood, there was never a Shabbat table or a holiday table that Yossi did not have a Dvar Torah, that Yossi did not have an inspirational message. And as he grew older, the sophistication of what he was saying and how he was saying it grew, and he became quite a competent teacher, and he loved more than anything to explain things. Yossi also loved to laugh. And more than that, he loved to make other people laugh. It was his greatest joy, was with people found him funny. And, well, he liked his mother. He was kind of a mama's boy. And we used to do this thing, what he called, we started when he was very young, but we called it this even as a grown young man, special day. We would go out kind of like on a date, you know, once a week, and we would talk. And he seriously enjoyed just being together and the give and take and the back and forth. And Yossi learned in many yeshivas. When he was in high school, he outgrew the system here, and he ended up in Toronto. And from there, he went to Brunois. He learned for 2 years in France. And then he joined a group of young emissaries, rabbis in Berlin. So he was all over. And then, after he got his smicha, his rabbinical ordination, Yossi was offered a post in the very same yeshiva where he had gone to school. And we were very excited because it meant that after all those years of learning away, Yossi was coming home. And it was a very, very special time for us. Yossi also loved nature and anything to do with nature, animals, or beautiful water, grass, trees, everything would get him excited. When he was a little boy, he was 11, was his first time in overnight camp. He went to a camp in the Catskill Mountains in New York. And when he came home after a month, I don't know if you've seen what an 11-year-old that's been away for a month in an all-boys camp looks like with boy counselors, and he was very happy, but he was grubby and grimy, and the luggage had that smell. And he came in and he said, "I brought you something." And he reached into his pocket and he pulled out a cracked plastic cup. And inside was a little green frog, and it was kind of jumping up and down. This frog had survived a 2.5-hour bus trip from the camp to the airport, and then the train from the plane from New York to LA, and then back to my house. And it looked very happy. Yossi had been feeding it bits of Bisley snack, and the frog looked really happy until it met me. But Yossi just had this thing about nature. And 2 years ago, well, 2.5 years ago, Yossi was a learning counselor in Chabad's camp in Costa Rica. And they took the boys on a scuba diving trip. And Yossi just fell madly in love, not so much with the diving experience, but with what he saw. He loved the underwater world. And he came home and he kept talking about it and talking about it. And after he got engaged, he wanted to learn how to do this. So he signed up for diving certification. And it was a very, very hectic Friday afternoon. I was working. I was a principal then. I was in school, and I came home. I was busy cooking for ourselves and for two other families, and I was on the phone making plans. We were preparing for a winter wedding. It was an extremely busy day. And then the phone rang, and there had been an accident. Yossi had to be pulled from the water, and he didn't have a pulse. And they were transporting him. And my husband rushed home, and two very close friends came over. I just turned off all the fires in the stove, and we ran to the hospital. And when we got there, you know how they have these cliches that they use that sound so dramatic that you think they never really use them in real life. But they do. They met us there, and they said to us, just like that, "We did everything we could, and we're so sorry." And in one instant, Yossi was gone. It was just over, just like that. And we didn't have a son. And they wouldn't let us stay at the hospital. It was almost Shabbat. It was getting very, very late. And we had to turn around. We had to go home. And that Sunday, we buried Yossi in the same cemetery where our four babies were buried. But when we came home that Friday, shell-shocked and in a major, major state of trauma, the table had already been set for Shabbat before I got the call. And Yossi always sat in the same chair. So there was his place, and it was set for him and his chair. And when I walked into the house, I could not look at that chair. And there it was, and it was Shabbat. There was nowhere to go. And so I did the only thing I could think of at that time, and it wasn't until later that I realized the significance of what I did. The only way not to see his chair was to sit in it. And that's what I did on that dark, dark, terrible Shabbat. I sat in Yossi's chair. And later I learned that in the 1970s, the Jewish Federation wanted to make a campaign so that people should remember that we lost so many Jews in the Holocaust. They felt that years are going by, and it's becoming just something that happened in history. We're not feeling the reality that we are bereft, we are missing people. So they wanted to reawaken that sensitivity to the huge, huge loss that we as a nation have experienced. So they came up with what they called the Empty Chair Campaign. And what they wanted was that for that year, on Passover, they would have every Jewish family put an empty chair at the Seder table. And in this way, they would see the empty chair, and they would remember, somebody is missing. There would have been another person here. But they wanted to gain publicity for this. They wanted people to know about it. So they approached the Chabad Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Brooklyn, New York, and they asked him for help, that he should get the word out to all his emissaries and all the different Chabad houses, that everybody is to put an empty chair at their Seder table. And the Rebbe said to them, the idea of putting an extra chair at the table is an excellent idea. But, the Rebbe said, the chair should not be empty. The people who died, they weren't empty chairs. Their lives had meaning. Their lives had potential. They had the things they did. They had the things they would have done. Put an extra chair by the Seder table, the Rebbe said, but fill the chair. Invite someone you normally wouldn't invite. Do something you normally wouldn't do. See, it's kind of a human tendency and perhaps expected that when there's something wrong in our lives, if there's an empty chair where somebody was, or if there's a missing chair, something that we wanted that's not been there at all, or something that's broken, to focus on what's broken, what's missing, what's empty, because the pain is so strong. But what the Rebbe was saying was, the pain is there. The tragedy is there. Find a way to fill the chair. Honor not just the fact that these people died, but the fact that these people lived. You want to remember them? Remember them for what they were. Remember them in such a way that the pain that you're feeling has meaning, has purpose. And so I began to think about ways in which to fill an empty chair. And the only way, really, to be able to do that is to focus on a soul level, to go step back and allow in a bigger picture. Because in truth, everybody has different challenges in life. And with every challenge that you have, with every empty chair, broken chair, missing chair, whatever is wrong in our lives, in that tragedy, within it, lies the potential for filling it in a much richer and deeper way. Doesn't take away the pain, but it makes it meaningful. For example, you have people who are struggling with loneliness, or the fact that I have a very, very close friend who became religious, and years and years and years are going by, and she wants more than anything just to get married and have a Jewish family. And she said to me once, I don't understand. I'm not asking to win the lottery. I'm asking to have a family so I can serve Hashem properly, so I can serve God at my own Shabbat table. I'm just asking for that. And the only thing I could say to her was, it's seems that what God is asking of you right now is to serve Him from this place of empty and of lonely. And I remember when my babies were in the neonatal intensive care unit and they were very sick, and I used to think, what a waste of time. I could be running the school, I could be hosting guests, I could be teaching, and here I am in the hospital again, talking to the doctors again, months and months. It seems like just a waste of time. But what I had to understand was what God wanted from me at this point was to go through this and to develop. And I learned it. I learned the preciousness of what it means to love unconditionally, to give love to a human being who will never, never smile at you and never give back to you. And in every one of our challenges, you speak to people who struggle with finances, and from them you can gain inspiration about priorities. You speak to people who struggle with health, and from them you can learn to experience the wonders of the body, the wonders of being human, the miracle of an hour pain-free or a moment pain-free. You speak to people who have to deal with situations that are embarrassing, and you can learn from them. They master the very, very special ability not to care what people think. And pretty much in every painful situation, if you're willing to step back and go for the soul of it, go for the purpose of it, we fill the chair. When my babies were ill, I came across a story that really changed the way I was thinking. The story is told of a very, very wealthy man who gave a lot of charity. And when he died, he came up to heaven, they said to him, you've done a lot of good. You're a great benefactor, and all the good that you did, it's going to help you. You're going to get credit for it. It doesn't go away. But there's a problem. You were always very arrogant. Whenever you gave money, you gave it because you wanted people to put your name up on the buildings or in the books that they give out, and you felt better than them. You condescended to them. You acted a little bit like you're the privileged one and you're doing them the favor. And in truth, you were supposed to really refine yourself. You were supposed to learn humility and how to treat people properly, and you didn't. You were too arrogant. Now, the soul without the body sees things very clearly, and this soul recognized that what it needed more than anything was to refine itself, was really to learn humility. And so the soul wanted this more than anything, because this would be the ultimate of the gains and the goal that this soul could accomplish. So they said to the soul, you're going to go back down into the world, you're going to be a rich man, and your job in this world, in this world down here, is to learn to be humble. And the soul said, if you send me down as a rich man, I'm not going to be able to learn to be humble. I don't know this from personal experience, but I understand that if you're very wealthy, it's harder to be humble. I guess you feel more privileged. It's going to be too difficult. Please send me down as a poor man. And initially he was told, no, your test is to go down as a rich man and to learn humility. And the soul begged, please, if you send me down as a rich man, it's the same thing is going to happen, and I'm going to feel on top of the world. I'm not going to learn humility. I want more than anything to accomplish what my soul needs to accomplish. So finally they said, okay, you get to go down as a poor man. Your role in life is to learn humility, to become a better, kinder, more humble person from the inside. But remember, you're going down as a poor man because your soul begged for this. And so, a very poor family, had a healthy baby boy, and he grew up, and he was the kind of person that everything he tried didn't work. He was bright, but he was one of those people that just kept trying, and he just couldn't make a go of it. But he forgot. He forgot that his soul begged for it, and instead of learning humility, he learned resentment and jealousy and bitterness. And why is it that I work so hard and here I am panhandling and he's got the corner office? He forgot that the circumstances of his life were exactly what his soul needed to do what his soul needs to accomplish in this world. The soul begged for it. So when we look at our lives and we look at the circumstances of our lives, and sometimes we want to ask, why all this? Why the family I was born into? Why this personality? Why this financial situation? Why this situation with marriage or not being able to have marriage? Why this situation with children? Why this embarrassing situation? Why this health problem? Why all these problems from around us and from within us? Why this temperament? Why these struggles? We have to remember, if we're looking at it from another way, then we're filling the cheer. We're taking the pain of what's wrong, of what's missing, and we're filling it with meaning, because we're looking at soul. And when you look at soul, you look at potential. And in every difficulty that we have lies tremendous potential. The pain is already there. The question is, how do we infuse the pain with meaning? But before we infuse the pain with meaning, we actually have to accept that the pain is real. And for me, that was actually quite a project. There was a pretty prolonged period of time where I could not accept the reality that after losing my four babies, I had lost a grown child, and it was very, very difficult. I saw a bumper sticker once that said, I keep pressing escape, but it doesn't work. I'm still here. And that was pretty much me for a very, very long time. Could not accept it. But eventually, with time, we came to a place where this is it. This is the reality. These are the cards I've been dealt. And I came to a place where I recognized this is my deal. There's a lot of loss, but this is my situation. And that sounds like it's a pretty big thing to do, but it's not enough. For a Jew to say, this is my deal, and I'll make it work somehow, I'll take whatever happened to me and I'll keep going, which seems like and is really a big deal, it's not enough. See, a Jew has to have joy. The Alter Rebbe writes, the first Chabad Rebbe writes about joy and the opposite of joy, that when a Jew is lacking joy, he's lethargic. He doesn't have energy. The sadness saps him of all his strength. And in order to serve God properly, you've got to come at it with energy, with vitality, with joy. But what happens if you have a reason to be unhappy, a real, legitimate reason to be sad? How then? How does someone like that find joy? So we have to look a little bit at what joy is. When my kids were very young, we went on a family trip. And at the end of the trip, when we were pretty much getting ready to get in the car to go home, my young daughter saw a store that sold T-shirts. And she decided that she really, really wants that a T-shirt. And we said, you don't need it, and we're going home already, and we had a good time, and that's that, and let's go in the car, and that's it. The whole way home was about over 2 hours. She kept insisting that if we only bought her that shirt, she will be happy for the rest of her life. She will never, ever ask for anything again. And the truth is, you know, you think, well, that might be a four-year-old, but the truth is that for many of us, when we think about what is joy, we tend to think, well, it's getting what I want, and if I just get what I want, then I'll be happy. And sometimes that keeps changing, but we do sometimes think that if I just had this thing, either an object or a state of being or whatever it is, if I just lived there or had this happen, then I'll be happy. The problem is that there are some of us who, as long as they live in this reality, this world, this body, the way things are now, someone like me, where I know that I will not get what I want in this reality now. I want my children back. I want to talk to my son. So if being happy is dependent on getting what you want, then for some of us it's not a possibility. And after Yossi died, there was quite a period of time there where I felt that I was not capable of being happy, and I was convinced that I never would be happy again. And I felt like, I know how important joy is. It's integral to serving God, but maybe I can get a note, you know, please excuse Devorah Kreiman from being happy. Her son died. Most of her kids died, you know. I wouldn't have to do it. The problem is, especially if we're filling empty chairs, that my son was such a happy child. It was just part of what he was. Yossi was a kind of child that was always looking for a laugh, and he was very, very witty. And he had like a personality quirk to him, many, but this is one, where if he didn't like something, instead of like outright complaining, he would use humor. I'll give you an example. Yossi and I have very different body temperatures. I'm always cold. I like the house cozy and toasty. Yossi was always hot, and he liked the house very, very cold. He liked the cold air blowing on him, and being that we lived in the same house, sometimes, you know, it led to a difference of opinion. And there was one point I remember when I had some people in the house, and the house was comfortable for me. And Yossi, instead of complaining, he walked into the room and he announced, "I grew up in a very warm home, 87 degrees. And this was his way. That's how he did things. Everything with him was humor, was light. Even things he didn't like, he found a way. And that first year when I withdrew from pretty much everyone and anyone close to me, and I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried, I could really almost feel like I was letting Yossi down. It was like I knew that he would be saying, "Come on, Ma, please. And do it for me. And if you're not going to do it for me, do it for you." But the truth is that if I am to honor him, I can't do it with grief and sadness. I have to find a way to find joy, because Yossi was joy, the essence of joy. So I set about trying to figure it out. How do we find joy? Avraham Joshua Heschel writes that when a Jew is sad, he cries. When he's sadder still, he is silent. But when he's saddest of all, he sings. And I remember that after Yossi died, without knowing this, I just wrote songs. Because singing comes from another place. You know, you can walk into a room and you can hear like a upbeat melody and it'll uplift you. Or you can hear a soul-stirring song and it'll touch your emotions. More than words and more than tears, song can go straight to the soul. And I realized that when we're talking about joy, real joy, we're talking about joy of the soul. The same way as essential sadness goes to the soul. Now, Yossi's birthday, of all days, is Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, is the day when both temples were destroyed. It's the saddest day of the Jewish year. And this is his birthday. And I always used to find that funny, because he was such an upbeat, happy child, born on the absolutely saddest day of the Jewish year. And the truth is that sadness and joy, when you go to the essence of both, what you're going to is soul. And if we are to look at what joy really is, the greatest joy that a person can experience is the feeling that they didn't live for nothing. The feeling that their life had meaning. The feeling that they accomplished something. But in order to do that, you have to look at the soul purpose. You have to look beyond the external of our situations and say, what can I do What potential is there in this difficulty? Because there are so many challenges. What potential is there in this situation that is frustrating, that is making me so anxious, that is embarrassing me, that is worrying me, that is hurting me? How can I, when I'm shattered or scared or whatever it is that we experience, how can I grow? How can I go to the soul of it and find meaning? So here we are, it's the month of Adar, very popular month. We have Purim, and we're told that in the month of Adar, we're supposed to have more joy. We're supposed to increase in joy, which means that there's an assumption that there was joy there before, and now we have to have more. But the word Adar also comes from the word Adir. Adir means strong, because it's not always so easy. We're talking about a level of joy that takes strength, level of joy that takes courage, because you're looking beyond the external. You're looking at the soul of it to find a way, even with pain and even with anxiety and frustration and all the difficult challenges that we're facing. You're looking into the depth of it, and you're finding not just a way to survive and endure, grit your teeth and get through it. You're finding a way to find joy, and that sometimes you need a little bit of adir. You need to work with strength, and it's not easy to do. So we have the story of Purim. And it's a fascinating lineup of characters. We have the very easily persuaded king, Achashverosh. We have a very determined and evil villain, Haman. We've got the ugly and mean queen, Vashti. We've got the beautiful and kind queen, Esther. We've got the righteous hero, Mordechai. We've got the whole lineup of interesting people, and we've got great drama. 11 months of drama. The story of Purim didn't happen in a day. For 11 months, every Jew who was alive in what was then pretty much the known world knew that they have a target on their back, that they're going to be killed, and there was nothing they could do about it. There was nowhere to go. There was no one to help them. And they were going to die. And then it all worked out. And those who wanted to kill the Jews were killed, and we were saved, and it was all very beautiful. And so we celebrate Purim. Wonderful, happy time. I have an adorable little grandson who loves to play peekaboo. And what he loves is if you pop up at him, he waits for it, and then when you pop up, he giggles. But he giggles especially if you pop up from an unexpected place. See, if he's expecting you to come from one side, and you come from the other side, if you come behind him or you come down lower, he giggles much more. Because sometimes joy is when you expect something, and something else happens. And that makes us kind of, it's like with a joke, and you build up the joke, and the whole thing that makes it funny is, that's not what I thought you'd say. And that's the peekaboo thrill, and that's the Purim thrill. We thought it would end one way, and it didn't. Because otherwise, life is just life. They were alive before, they were alive after. What's the big celebration? We thought it wouldn't work out. It looked like this was going to be a really terrible situation, and then, wow, surprise, we laugh, we celebrate. It's Purim. But when you look at the Megillah, you look at the story of Purim, the Jews were targeted for one reason only, because they were Jews. And because they were Jews, every man, woman, and child is going to be murdered. They're going to be killed only because they're God's nation. So you have to ask, where was God? We don't see God anywhere in the story of Purim. And we're talking about a situation where the Jews are being killed because they are the nation of God. And yet we don't see God like you have by Egypt, where God says that he heard their cries and God responds. Nothing. The story just goes along, and we have this important person, and it was a very good thing that Mordechai happened to overhear, and it's a very good thing that the queen happened to be Jewish, and it just all worked out. But God is not there at all. God is completely missing. And sometimes in our lives also we say, where was God? Where is he? What happened to him? There's a story of two little boys that went to Sunday school, Talmud Torah, and they weren't happy about being there because they were in public school all week, and here on Sunday they have to learn with a rabbi. So they gave their teacher a difficult time. And finally the teacher couldn't manage anymore, so he went to the rabbi and he said, these two boys are making it impossible for me to teach. So the rabbi decided that he's going to speak to the two boys and he's going to explain to them that you're in a synagogue and it's a house of God, and God is everywhere and God is watching you. So you have to behave well because God is everywhere. So he called the two boys to the office and he made one wait outside and he called the other one in. That's a good tactic, used to be a principal. And then he said to the first boy, do you know where God is? And the kid is just looking at him. So now he's upset. So he thunders at the child, do you know where God is? And the little boy turns around white-faced. He runs out of the office. He grabs the other little boy, fast, fast, run, and they start running all the way home. And when they get there, the boy turns to him and says, what happened in there? And he said, God is missing, and they think we hit him. Do you know where God is? Sometimes we don't know where God is. Where is God? We're being targeted just because we're his nation. Where is God? God was there all along. When you read the Megillah at a soul level, when you read the Megillah with the explanations, you see that not only was God there, but God was orchestrating all of it, putting everything in place. God never, never abandons his people. God was there all the time. But we have to look for it. See, Purim, we have an unusual requirement on Purim. Our sages tell us that on Purim, you're obligated to drink. And not only you're obligated to drink, but the expression used is actually you should become, it's kind of similar to the word besamim. You should become fragrant with drink. You should smell like you drank. You really are supposed to drink. And not only that, you're supposed to drink to the extent that you get it all mixed up, that you don't know the difference between cursed as Haman and blessed as Mordechai. And you know, you have to wonder, I mean, we're a people of the book, and this is not the way that people usually associate Jews with. There's got to be a more refined way to celebrate, a more appropriate way for who we are. And the truth is, as far as the drinking, it's not necessarily about drinking the liquor, it's about what the drinking does. See, Purim is a time when either drink, or if you can't drink, then don't drink, but act as if you drank. See, when you drink, your intellect kind of takes a break a little bit, and that's what Purim is about. Put the intellect out of the way. So much you should do this, say our sages, that you get it all mixed up. You don't get it right. You don't know who is Haman and who's Mordechai. You get it all mixed up. It's like the guy that was pulled over by the cop and he insisted, officer, I swear to drunk, I'm not God. You know, get it all mixed up. That's Purim. That's Purim. Purim is when you stop using your mind. Because when you use your mind, and you say, this doesn't make sense. How could it be? How can God allow it? How could such a thing happen? Where is God? Doesn't God care? Doesn't God know? And we start using our minds. And we start determining, well, this is a good thing, and this is a bad thing. Comes Purim, and God says, you know, intellect is a very important thing. But on Purim, throw it out. Get so drunk that you understand that you don't understand that good and evil and what happened to you, it's all one big blur. You can't understand it. What happens when you can't understand? When the intellect is gone, that's where the faith comes in. Because faith is when you don't see it. If you can see it, then you're not going on faith. And they say about Californians, actually, I think they say there's science, there's logic, there's reason, and then there's California. And we would have to add, and then there's the Jew. You know, put it all aside. Just put it all aside and hold your faith that God has never and will never abandon us. God was there. God is there all the time, but more than that, we're going to go home safe and sound. We're going to be okay. We're going to be all right because God never, never leaves us alone. I don't play sports and I don't know anything about sports, but I remember hearing this story. There was a woman who was a very avid sports fan and she had an important game that her team was playing and she had an important meeting at the same time, so she couldn't watch the game. So she asked a close friend to tape the game. And after the meeting, she went to pick up the tape. And her friend told her, by the way, your team won. And I don't think you're supposed to do that, but it kind of ruined it for her. So she said that she went home and she figured she has the tape, she may as well watch it anyway. I guess we're talking about VCR tapes, a long time ago. So she popped in the tape and she's watching it. And she says that her team did really, really poorly. They were taking quite a beating. And normally, she says that she would have gotten really upset. She would have yelled at the screen and thrown things. I guess people do that. And, you know, she would have gotten like really, it would have ruined her day. But she said she didn't because she knew that it looks really bad, but she knew that they win. So she knew that it's okay. So she was able to take whatever came because it works out okay in the end. But there's a trick to that because it doesn't always go that quickly. When the third of our four sick children was in the hospital, her name was Hannah, and she was in the hospital for 5.5 months. We had two friends who I actually just spoke to tonight, and I was reminding them of this. Two very close friends who gave us a really unusual gift. They gave us a box with 100 t-shirts, big T-shirts, and they said in very bright, kind of funky letters, "Expect a miracle." And they gave us this T-shirt to give out in the hospital. And there was not a single staff member in that NICU who believed that Hannah Kreiman was going to live. I mean, she was the third of her siblings to die from this. I mean, she hadn't died yet, but she was very, very sick. And they told us, give out the T-shirts, and we did. If you were a nurse who came in to adjust a tube, or you were some very important surgeon, it didn't matter, whoever you were, if you came into contact with tiny little Hannah Kreiman, you got a T-shirt. Expect a miracle. Because that's what we do. And they would ask us, and we would explain it. We're Jews. We expect a miracle. We know what the doctors are saying, but we expect a miracle. Hannah died. We still expect a miracle. It's what we do. It's who we are. This is how we go. And the way it works, really, I remember when I was a child, someone explained it to me as absolute truth and relative truth. I remember my teacher telling us to visualize a beautiful tapestry. And you're looking at the back of the tapestry, and you're seeing knots and threads all over, and it's a mess. And what you're seeing is true. It's relative truth. What you're looking at is messy and ugly. But you're looking at it from the other side. And if you see the front of the tapestry, it's a work of art. It's beautiful. That's the absolute truth. It's like I remember hearing about the 3D. The way that they film 3D is that it's actually two pictures going in at the same time. And if you don't have the glasses, all you see is a blur. We look at our lives, and we see what's in front of us, and we make determinations. This is bad, this is good. But really, we're missing half the picture. There's a whole nother picture there. And sometimes, even if we don't have the glasses, all we can do is say, I know that I don't have the whole deal. I know that I'm not seeing the whole thing. I'm only seeing what's in front of me, but I have the advantage of understanding that there's so much more to it. Like when you talk to another person, the part that's giving that person life is their soul. There's so much more to the person than what you can see. Their feelings, their intellect, their soul. There's so much more to what we experience and so much potential to what we go through in the way that we choose to bring it out. But it's work. It's absolute work. And it says about Purim, well, actually, it's about liquor in general. In Hebrew, it's done that when wine goes in, secrets come out. The Hebrew word for wine is yayin, and the Hebrew word for secret is sod, and both of them equal 70. Because when wine goes in, secrets come out. You know, people will share all. But that's what happens on Purim. The wine goes in, so the secrets come out. And the secret is that God was there, that God didn't abandon his people, that God didn't blink or take a break or have a mess up or not care. God was there. That is the secret that comes out when we drink on Purim. And it comes out because we stop using our intellect and we go to our faith. We connect to the part within us that knows that God would never abandon us and that whatever we are going through at some level carries with it the potential for greatness in each of us. We come to touch that. The wine goes in. That's the secret that keeps us going. And it's not a secret that we can understand. That said, the pain of our circumstances is still very real. There was a father who had two very seriously handicapped children. And he says that whenever he would go out, people would remind him that, you know, these children are a gift. And he said that sometimes he felt like turning to God and saying, a gift? God, really, you shouldn't have. You know, sometimes it's just, it doesn't take away the pain, it doesn't take away the difficulty, but it helps to understand. Reb Baruch, the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, used to say a prayer every Friday night. And he used to say, I thank you, God, for the kindness that you have done for me and for the kindness that you're going to do for me. And one time I stopped and he asked, why am I thanking God for the kindness that he's going to do for me? When he does it, I'll thank him. And then he answered his own question. And he said that it's possible that when God will do the kindness for me, I won't recognize it as kindness and I won't thank him. And then he started to cry. And he said, it is so sad that God will be doing a kindness for me, and I won't even know. But in some way, if we think that God is always there, my point of view is sometimes it makes it even harder. See, if we could say that maybe God doesn't really supervise everything, then things happen. There's accidents. My son died in a freak accident. There are accidents. The Holocaust, God blinked for a while, some terrible people took over. It happened. It makes it in some way easier to deal with than to say no. Nothing happens without God. If we are to believe, and we do, that God controls every single detail of our lives, then really we have to deal with something else. We have to deal with the fact that God can be very, very cruel. Because if it wasn't an accident, and God didn't blink, and it didn't happen by mistake, and every detail of the lives of every single one of us here, and every single one of us everywhere, every detail has been orchestrated by God, then when painful things happen, we have to say, well, God set me up for this, knowing who I am, knowing how much I love, well, in my case, my son, knowing my personality, knowing what a terrible blow this would be, no accident. God knew every detail. And still God not only let it happen, but made it happen. So then we have to deal with the question, how could God be so cruel? How could God let that happen? And we do believe that God makes it happen. How then do we deal with it? Viktor Frankl, in his work on man's search for meaning, he talks about the beginning of the Holocaust. He was a young doctor, and he had just written his first book. He had the manuscript of his first book, and he was taken to Auschwitz. And he writes how he had the manuscript of this book in his pocket with him. And he was thinking that he didn't know what had happened to his wife, and he did not have a physical child to survive him. And if something were to happen to this manuscript, which he was feeling was his mental child, it was all of his effort and all of his hard work, if something were to happen to that manuscript, he was questioning whether his life would be worth living. And he was dealing with this concept of meaning. What's the point of it all? And he writes that he was unaware at that time that God had already prepared the answer for him. He got to Auschwitz. They took his coat. They took his manuscript. They took everything. And they gave him the worn out rags of an inmate who had been gassed right before him. And he put his hand in the pocket. The manuscript wasn't there. There was one piece of paper torn from a Hebrew prayer book. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And he writes that he understood this as a message for God, not to write about meaning, think about meaning, but to live it. God was telling him, in that place there in Auschwitz, yes, you've lost everything you can lose, but God is one. God is with you. And he understood that as a challenge to live. What is a life of meaning? It takes work. It takes a different set of glasses. King Solomon, the wisest man of all men, he writes, I have seen the advantage of wisdom from foolishness and light from darkness. It translates as wisdom is better than foolishness and light is better than darkness. And we have to wonder, I mean, do we really need the wisest of all men to tell us that wisdom is better than foolishness and light is better than darkness? But our sages explain that that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, I have seen the advantage of wisdom from foolishness and light from darkness. So you can gain wisdom in many ways. You can read books and you can go to classes, and that's a very good wisdom. But there's another kind of wisdom. You make a foolish mistake and you pay for it and you learn from it, and that's a very different kind of a wisdom. That's a wisdom from foolishness, and it's far more profound and far more enduring than just the wisdom that you learn academically. Wisdom from foolishness. And we have the same thing with light and darkness. There's light, there's good in our lives, but there's another kind of light, a far deeper light, and that is the light that comes from the darkness itself. In the year since, well, 2 years and 4 months since Yossi died, we are starting to see tremendous light from the darkness. There are libraries set up for him, more than one at this point. I think we're up to the third one now. There are thousands and thousands of people who have reached out, who have heard about him and his joy and his humor and his wisdom. And this experience, light from darkness. The darkness is there, but the light that comes from it is deeper. It's a soul light. It's an essential light. And this past summer, I spoke for a group of college students. We're talking about challenges and how to meet them. And afterwards, some of them came over to talk. And one young college girl told me a very, very sad story that had happened to her, something really life-changing. And I asked her, are you the same person now as you were before this happened? And she said, not at all. I'm a completely different person. And then I asked her, which person do you like better? Without missing a beat, she said, the new one. And I said, look at the price you paid, but already, and it was very recently after what had happened, you are already telling me that you like the new person that came from this better. And that's what light from darkness is, and that's what soul joy is. After Yossi died, we made quite a few trips to Israel because there's a lot of strength and faith and joy. And at one point, I was at a group of bereaved mothers, all of whom had lost an older child, not a baby, but a child that they had spent many years, you know, putting in, raising their children. And a question was asked. Someone asked, would you have preferred not to have had the child at all, or to have had the child and lost the child? And I was shocked. Almost half the people in the room said that it was so painful to lose a child that they would have preferred never to have had the child. And a little more than half the people there, the pain is so tremendous that I could see where they were coming from, but more than half, slightly more than half, myself firmly included in the other half, said not at all. As much as the pain of losing a child is constant, and it's raw, and it's acute, and it's so horrific, I know that I am a much, much better person for having had Yossi. He enriched me so much, he gave me so much, that even though it's this terrible, terrible difficulty of trying to go on without him, find joy without him, I would not give that up for anything. And in the beginning I used to say, I am a better person because I had Yossi. Now I'm starting to say that I'm starting to think about the possibility that I may even be a better person for having lost him. That is light from darkness. And it doesn't happen quickly. It's a project. This is all big picture. I want to digress for a moment and talk about small picture. I want to give you a cheap trick, if you will, about finding joy in your lives. Other than the whole soul thing, there's a really neat and easy way. The day before Yossi died, it was a Thursday, and I was cooking. And he was in the kitchen. He was supposed to be helping me, but what was really happening was I was cooking and he was eating everything as quickly as I was making it. And we were talking. And he was saying to me that he's nervous. He has to set up an apartment and he doesn't know what he needs and he's not sure how he's going to get it. And where do you buy all those things? And I said, don't worry. We'll help you. We'll show you. You'll work it out, you know. And then he said to me, tell you what, Ma, you've got all this great stuff here. How about I just take? And I said to him, sure, whatever you want, just tell me what you want. And my back was turned to him, and I was busy, and he was busy. Then I turned around, and I saw Yossi had taken little yellow post-it notes. And he had written Yossi and Chayala, his name and his bride's name, and he had put those post-it notes everywhere. My fridge, my stove, my sink, my KitchenAid, my Cuisinart, everything has post-it notes. Yossi and Chayala, Yossi and Chayala. And we laughed, you know. And then I said to him, Yossi, it's amazing how somebody that you didn't know for most of your life is soon going to be the closest person in the world to you. And he said to me, you're the closest person in the world to me, Ma. And I said, Yossi, you're getting married. If your mother is the closest person in the world to you, we have a little problem. But, you know, at 23, you know everything. He said, no, I got this. That's my wife. That's a different relationship. I know, you know. But right now, in this kitchen, you are the closest person to me. And then he was talking about how he wanted to spend the holidays together, and I was reminding him that there would have to be someone else he'd have to check with. But we were talking, but it was a very significant moment because he died the next day. And I remember thinking that because he died so suddenly, what about all the things that we never got to say? What about all the unfinished business? And I realized he hears me still. He knows my love for him. But how would he have told me? He gave me and my husband in the weeks before the wedding. It was a very sentimental time because we were doing so much with him. And he was thanking us more than he normally would have. So he thanked us not only for the wedding, but for everything else that we were doing. He gave us a precious gift of telling us what we meant to him and what we had done for him. And I thought about it because sometimes we're very casual about acknowledging what it is that's good in our lives for ourselves and to other people. You want to find joy? First to yourself. Acknowledge what is right and what is good. This was an ordinary Thursday afternoon, me and my son in the kitchen, but he turned it, as was characteristically him, into a time of closeness and wisdom and, of course, humor and joy. Take the time in the ordinary to acknowledge what works in your life, to acknowledge what's right, to acknowledge what's good, and then take the time to turn to the people who mean so much to you and tell them. Not because they may die and then it's going to be too late, but because they will live and your relationship will be deeper. And sometimes we assume, you know, oh, they know, or it's embarrassing, but it's a tremendous gift and it has to be said. There was a couple who went to a marriage counselor and the wife complained and she said, my husband never tells me that he loves me. So the counselor turned to the husband and said, is that true? And he said, look, 30 years ago, I told her that I love her. If anything changes, I'll let you know. But you can't do that. You have to say, you have to tell them, you have to spell it out. It's good for you. It's good for them. When you want to find joy, the first step is to turn to God and say thank you. To turn to the people in your lives and say thank you for what you mean to me. And it's a sad fact that sometimes it's those of us who have lost the most who are most appreciative. And it shouldn't be that way. We all have so much good. That's just a small little picture. The big picture, just to wrap it up, is really stepping back and finding that soul in us, the soul purpose, and finding meaning and finding a way to believe. I was once rollerblading on a path by the beach, not my finest hour, because I'm kind of adequate on the skates, but not awesome. And I realized, to my horror, that the path that I was on was suddenly a little smoother than I was ready for, which meant I was going faster than I was able to safely. And then I realized, to my greater horror, that the path slopes downhill. There was no way to stop. I wasn't that good on the blades. I have no idea how to stop. Nothing to hold on to. And I knew I was going to fall. And I'm going faster, faster, faster down that slope. And at the bottom of the slope, there was a pole. And I thought, if I can just get to that, maybe I'll be okay. So I went for the pole. I hit it so hard that I fell backwards and it hit the back of my head, which probably explains a few things. But when I first fell, initially, when you fall like that, you get the wind knocked out. I mean, the wind was just knocked out of me. I couldn't breathe. I was just like, just laid there for a little bit. And then, you know, I'm a survivor. I thought, okay, let's see. Let's make a plan. What used to work? What still works? I used to be able to move my arms. Can I still move my arms? I could. I used to be able to move my legs. Can I still move my legs? I could. All right. So I'm kind of bruised and battered and in pain, but what works still works, so I can go. Yossi died. It was pretty much the same thing, what we call a zets. The kind of blow that, in Yiddish, it's a strong word. I don't think there's an English word for it, but it's kind of smack that moves you along. It was pretty much a year where we had the wind knocked out of us, and I couldn't do pretty much anything that I had done before. Just shell-shocked, had the wind knocked out of me. As we started to prepare for the first yard site, for the first anniversary of Yossi's death, and the community was opening the first of the libraries dedicated for him, and they asked me to speak, and I started to take stock. And I started to ask myself, what used to work? What still works? I used to believe in God. Do I still believe in God? I do. If I believe in God, then I believe that there's a plan. And I believe that my soul has a purpose in this world, and that includes bringing these souls into this world and letting them go, that I have a job, that my life still has meaning. I believe that nothing happens by accident. I believe, so I'm bruised and I'm battered, but forward we go. But you know, you look at the story of Purim, and we're talking about that everything worked out well. So you think, well, yes, there was faith. It was 11 months, but it worked out right. It worked out great. I mean, we've got the hamantashen and the costumes, and it was an almost. Those are the best things to have. Almost. We almost all died, but we didn't. We got this great holiday instead. You might wonder, when we look at our own lives sometimes, it doesn't work out that way. It's not quite like the story of Purim, where it looked like it was going to be really bad, and God was not there, but then God came through big time, and everything worked out. But what about if we're dealing with a life situation where we're not seeing the happy ending, or the possibility of a happy ending? It just is what it is, and we know this is the reality, and we don't really see a way, other than Mashiach coming this instant, which really is the way, that things should turn around. So how then do we find joy if we don't have the expectation that things are going to change? So I'm just going to end with a short story. In 1942, there was a cattle car of Jews headed to the death camps. And in that cattle car was a young man, a Majitzer Chassid. The Majitzer are a group of Chassidim that were known for their musical ability. And this man was composing a tune to the words of Ani Mamin. Ani Mamin is I believe, with perfect faith in the coming of Mashiach, in the coming of the Messiah. And even if he will delay, I will wait for him every day, I believe. And he was on his way to pretty certain death, and he was composing a song to these words, and he was putting together the tune, and he was singing it, and soon the people around him started to sing it, and after a while, the entire cattle car was singing this song, Ani Mamin, I believe. And then the man said, I will share my portion in the world to come. The world to which we come from before we're born, the world to which we go to afterwards, the main world. I will share my portion in the world to come with anyone who brings this song to freedom. If you can get this song out to a place where Jews are not dying, you will share my portion in the world to come. There were two yeshiva boys on this train, and they decided that they were going to do it. There was a little ear hole or something at the top of the train, and when the train rounded the next curve and slowed down a little bit, they jumped from the train. One of them was shot and killed right there on the embankment. The other one managed to get away, and somehow he made his way all the way across Europe. He made his way to the United States, and he came to the Chabad Rebbe, to the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe in Brooklyn. He told him the story, and he sang the song to him. And the Rebbe cried, and then the next Rosh Hashanah, bringing in the year 1943, the previous Chabad Rebbe said, we have regards from the Valley of Tears. And he taught this song. And this song became known as the Lubavitcher Ani Mamin, the song of I believe. And when you think about this story, it doesn't look like it ended well. This man died. They all died. And this young boy died trying to bring it to freedom. But the man is gone. The song lives on. The message lives on. And what this man did, his courage, his faith, what he did as he was going to his death, continues to give and give and give to us. And countless Jews, when we're feeling dejected, afraid, lost, we hang on to that. This man gives us strength. He gives me personally strength. We remind ourselves whenever we're having a hard time, and we gain strength, we gain guidance, we gain inspiration, because we remind ourselves, I am a Jew. I believe. I believe. Thank you.
Wow. I'm pretty speechless after that. Thank you. And God should give you and your family renewed strength and vigor to bring your timely message to the world that is in need of assistance and uplifting. You're very special. God bless you. The Crymans are running to a wedding, but a couple of questions, I think.
You want me to come back up?
I think so, yeah. We'd like you to speak next month, maybe.
Well, here I am. But yes, a very good friend is making a wedding tonight, so we go from sadness to to joy. And somebody actually said to me tonight that they're one. You know, the sadness of this couple that I spoke about that gave us the T-shirts. So he was at the wedding, and I said to him, you know, I still have that T-shirt, and I still talk about that T-shirt. We're talking, it was 15 years ago. And he said to me, you can have sadness and joy together. And I said, yes, they can be the same. They could be the same. So if you have questions, I'll stay for a couple of minutes, and then, yes, we do have a wedding to go to. Go to the wedding? They told me to go to the wedding. Only my husband has questions. He doesn't get to ask in front of everyone. Sure, go ahead. Sure, yeah.
You mentioned that getting there, overcoming and bringing the light to the darkest point of work, you mentioned that a few times, so how do you see that process of work?
It's a great question. A lot of it, this was a short, there's only so much we can get in, but a lot of it really is what you tell yourself. She's asking that what is the work? We talk about the work. To me, it's really as simple as just telling myself many different things that need to be said. In other words, this particular talk is about belief, because Purim is coming, so I would remind myself that God is good, that God runs the world, that we're going to be okay, even if we don't believe it. I mean, look, we're in California. This is the land of make-believe, so we can do what's if, you know, and remind ourselves even if we don't feel it. But the biggest tool, the greatest thing that helps me, is that I remind myself to do one moment at a time, and I tell myself, this one moment, I can be as strong as I need to be, just for now, just for a moment, and then I'll deal with the other moment later. And I do that all the time. I tell myself, if I need to be just a little stronger for my children, or a little bit more spiritual, and I'm not feeling like I can, I just trick myself into saying one moment, just one moment. And actually, I have a good friend that tries to help me with this, and at one point I was telling her, I can't, and we reach those points where we feel we can't, and she says, what did you say about doing one moment at a time? And I said, yes, but there's so many moments. Every time I do a moment, there's another one and another one. And she said, yes, but you only do one at a time. So that's what it is. I just keep telling myself things. I also learn, after Yossi died, but even after the babies, I learned the bigger picture. We think sometimes, and some people have the luxury of assuming that this is the whole deal. Life in this world is everything, and the challenges are the whole thing, and the pleasures are everything. You get a little older, you realize that's not really true. Or you get hit hard enough, you have to step back and look at the bigger picture, which is there's more than one world. There's another world. There's something bigger than all of us. We're only here to do a job. And I think about that a lot. I remind myself all the time. There's another world. There's a world of souls. God is watching us. I actually made my own affirmations, spiritual affirmations, and I would remind myself of them all the time. So it's work, but it's only one moment at a time. Anybody can do anything for one moment. So that's how we do it. And sometimes we mess up. Sometimes it's one step forward and two steps backwards, but at least there's one step forward also, and we struggle. And my husband is an incredibly spiritual and warm, special human being, and he makes it easy in that way. Any questions? Can I go? Thank you. Rabbi Eimender, I think I've been dismissed. It's a very close friend's wedding, but if you have questions, I'll be happy to stay and talk. Most of the time, people like to do it individually. I'll stay for a little bit.
Please come back.
Pleasure.
God bless.
Yossi's bar mitzvah was here. I love this place.
All right.
Thank you.